Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. On The Long View this morning, we talk about the turn of events on the national political scene. We focus on the decisions that need to be made leading up to the Democratic National Convention. We have been hearing a lot about the military's RIMPAC exercises in waters off our shores. Today, we talk about its possible climate impacts. We get a reaction to the youth climate settlement, this time from Oregon and Montana. And countdown to the primary election, we hear about a pledge from candidates to turn down campaign money from corporations and other large groups. It is Wednesday, July 24th. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Countdown to the Democratic National Convention. It takes place in Chicago in less than a month. But now that President Joe Biden has decided not to run and has endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris, a lot needs to be decided. A lot has to happen between now and then. Here to help sort out this unfolding drama is our contributing editor, Neil Milner. Good morning.
Good morning. Unfolding drama for sure. It's like dealing with a moving target, but the target is sort of stationary now.
Yeah, but I just had a week of whiplash.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, let's just talk about the difference between what might have happened. I'm not talking about whether Biden had stayed in, but what might have happened and what seemed to have happened. One thing that might have happened that didn't, a fundamental, is that you would have had more candidates tossing their hats in the ring. And from the day that Biden took office last time and said he was going to be a bridge candidate, there has never really been a serious Democratic contender who built on that hint and became forward. And so the absence of any contenders, even before Biden had said he was going to run again, is very notable because it takes the contest out of here. The other factor is that the $91 million that the Biden Harris unit, that can only go to them legally. So if she wasn't the candidate, that would disappear. That money by law has to go back to the donors. But the main thing is there's just no contest anymore. Conventions have moved from being the place where you selected the presidential candidate. In fact, before there were hardly any primaries and they weren't binding, to a place where it's pretty much a done deal ordinarily because the delegates have already been chosen and for the most part committed. So there was no real tradition anymore to have a contested presidential convention where you would have other candidates. No candidates to do it. That tradition is gone. And so the move forward from Harris was very quick. It's easy for the delegates who can back away from the old candidates that they were afforded to go there. And so now, in effect, you're going to have a real convention, but there's something called a virtual convention that's going to happen on August 7th. It's like your biggest Zoom meeting possible, where I guess the delegates don't have to wear pants like you did for Zooming. But here's the reason for that. Originally, there was going to be a virtual convention anyway as a kind of informal thing because there were state laws that the Democrats worried that they would violate. Ohio had a law that says you had to have your candidate declared by a certain date or you couldn't get on the ballot. Well, that's not a good thing. So I think that deadline was before the convention. So the Democrats had set up this virtual convention. Now it's taken on something with a much more binding meaning, not binding in an official sense, binding enough for the state laws to accept Harris as a nominee. There still will be a nominating process at the convention, but the process is much closer to the Republicans, where it was a sure thing. I mean, and it's much closer to that a pro forma situation.
Well, I think just the general interest, you know, with the Republican convention, right? I mean, given the assassination attempt and who was Trump going to choose as his running mate, you know, the interest was high there, and just to see him, right? I mean,
following that.
Well, shooting.
I mean, conventions, that's what conventions do. But the other thing is, you always want to look at where the conventions are. It's not a coincidence that the 2020 Democratic convention was to be held in Milwaukee, and it was kind of stunted because of COVID, and the 2024 Republican convention was held in Milwaukee. Now, Milwaukee is a heavily Democratic city, but Wisconsin may be the swingiest of all swing states. So that certainly played a role in that kind of selection, because so much about what's going to happen and it has to do with those, let's say, 6 to 12 close states. The election will be decided by them. And one of the reasons that the Democrats got really frightened and put more pressure on Biden to drop out is that he was starting to do whatever his own people said. The polls were showing his support in that area was dropping.
Slipping. Yeah,
and the hypothetical electoral maps, well, what it would look like if the election were held on that day, like last week, are pretty scary for the Democrats.
Yeah, and lots of people now are fixated on who will Harris pick for her running mate, and a number of those potential candidates come from those swing states.
Well, that's right. Picking vice presidential candidates, it's like a fantasy game for people. They've got all kinds of these theories, right? Now, most of the time, and I tell people this, and I say there's research that backs it up, doesn't make much difference who they do. The vice presidential choice doesn't make that much difference on the ticket. And then they'll throw back Sarah Palin, who messed it up for the Republicans, and I have an argument about that. But the point is that the swing state thing has a certain logic to it. And in an election that's close, you might want to do it. And there's a kind of American political culture logic that pundits put forward, where if you have a candidate who's one way, you got to have a balance who's the other. So what do you have here? You have a African-American woman, part Indian. So what do you look for? A white guy. And then she's from California. We know what that means. So we're looking for somebody who's from a more moderate state. Well, that actually translates in this day and age into Democratic governors who are able to work with Republicans. That's one of the reasons that the Kentucky governor and the North Carolina governor, and to some extent the governor of Maryland, who is an up-and-comer. But then you think about this is America,
balance,
after all, right? He's a young African-American guy who does work very— the Democratic Party in Maryland is kind of different because they have to work with Republicans a lot. So that's where we stand. It's the question that I get all the time, and I answer the same way that I'm answering all this other stuff. We are in an unprecedented situation, and much more, we're in flux in that situation. And so it's hard to say anything. I'll give you a quick example. Normally, after a convention, the presidential candidate, this is for both parties, who's chosen gets what's called a bump. Their percentage of the vote goes up. The bump tends to level off over time. It's the same with debates generally. This one was a little bit different. Now you've got two bumps against each other because it looks as if there is a Harris bump. One of the prognosticators, one of the ways that you look at elections, this is a little bit up in the air. And of course, we haven't had a candidate who's come this late to the scene. It couldn't be. I mean, really.
Yeah, it's a cliffhanger.
Yeah, so it's too early to tell anything for sure. The best thing that you can use to reassure yourself, I don't mean that your candidate is going to win, is to look at aggregates of polls over time. I know people don't like polls. They're still better than what's in most folks' heads. But it takes time to see what this is, you know, what this is going to do. It takes time to see what the polls are showing over time.
Yeah, it's just curious that a lot of those potential candidates are former prosecutors as well.
No, yeah. That's true.
It's interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting career move. We could talk about that for a while.
Yeah, so I think lots of eyes will be on the
yes,
convention.
Yes.
But thanks so much, Neil.
You're welcome. Take care.
That was our contributing editor, Neil Milner, talking to us about the fast-changing political landscape as the Democrats head into their convention next month.
Unexplained aerial phenomena.
Well, if there's a lunar thing, it's rotating.
More people are asking if the U.S. government is covering up what it knows. Is the truth out there? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering a Master of Accounting program. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
The Rim of the Pacific military exercises are well underway. The largest multinational war games end next week. Today, we focus on the emissions from the drills. Nita Crawford is the author of the book, The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, Charting the Rise and Fall of U.S. Military Emissions. She is a professor of international relations at Oxford University, and she got fixed on this topic, looking for data, for a political science lecture when she was at Boston University. Crawford was surprised when the data wasn't readily available.
So I began on a path to discover what's the impact of the military, and I didn't expect it to be huge. And what I found was that the Department of Defense is the United States' single largest energy user, which surprised me. I also found that it's one of the largest greenhouse gas emitters in the world. And I had no idea. And I've studied the military for 40 years. So then I wanted to understand how it got that way. And that started me on a path of, you know, calculating emissions because they're not readily available. The United States and the Kyoto Protocol negotiations wanted an exemption for military emissions, and they got it. And so they're not reported.
But so they're not tracking it.
No. Right. So it's sort of uncounted. And it's not just the installation emissions or the operational emissions. It's also emissions from military industry and war. We don't have a good handle on the wartime emissions. And it's a huge problem we need to understand. But just the emissions from bases, installations, and operations and exercises like RIMPAC are significant. And they can be reduced, and that's why I was interested in it.
So how can they be reduced?
Well, there's a couple ways. One is you could green the fuels, and in 2016, RIMPAC did have some green fuels. The naval fuel was 10% biofuel, and you could reduce the amount of exercises or do more computer simulations for training. Or you could, in fact, reduce the overall footprint of the military, that standing footprint, the bases and the installations, and the size of the forces. Because most of the emissions are operational, but installations are about 30% of emissions. And the DOD itself says that they have excess capacity at their bases. They have about 20% excess capacity. So there's room there for consolidation and reduction, and they want to do it. So there are ways to reduce the emissions that involve sort of rethinking what the military's role is and also rethinking its huge global presence and whether or not that is helpful for peace and how it is that you can change the way militaries operate, their deterrent postures, and actually be as safe or safer and be smaller, less expensive, less polluting.
The military is taking stock, closed bases, realigned bases. Mm-hmm. They have given back surplus land in some areas, but environmental cleanup is a problem in some areas as well. You know, where we know better now about the chemicals that we shouldn't have disposed of in a certain way.
Right. Well, it's fuel and it's chemicals to put out fires and it's burning things. It's dumping fuel that's unused. It's chemicals leaking into the ground and then the groundwater. I mean, the big thing that we've been working on, Leonard DeClercq and I, is tracking the carbon dioxide emissions of the operations. This is the thing that is invisible, right? Carbon dioxide is an invisible gas, but of course it contributes to global warming. And we've for a long time understood the harm that those chemicals do in the ground and in the water and some of the dust and air pollution in war zones. But we really hadn't really understood the contribution of the military to climate change, to warming, that then exacerbates other problems.
And we have seen the military take steps to put in, you know, green energy, whether they be solar farms, you know, like we have here coming up on military land and that kind of thing in an effort to be greener. But do you think that we're not doing enough?
No, we're not. I mean, and I think they themselves recognize that. But the thing that we see is that the rest of the world has increased its use of solar, wind, geothermal. And the military tells us that they're an innovator in those technologies. And they can, in some ways, be innovators, but their rate of uptake of those technologies is slower than it could be, in fact, should be. And the point really isn't necessarily to green the military. The point is to reduce its size, because the installations, as I said, are only about 30% of the emissions. It's 70% is operational, and most of that is aircraft. The fuel that's consumed by a plane is... they don't get miles per gallon, they get gallons per mile. And the same with military vehicles that are on land. So they're not only inefficient, but much of this training could be done in a different way through simulations and the exercises like RIMPAC, which, you know, this year are the largest in terms of the number of participating nations than ever before, and includes 25,000 people, you know, doing what militaries do, which is consuming energy to have mobility and operations and testing new equipment. That's something that happens every other year, but it has the emissions profile that's similar to Washington, D.C. in a year. If my estimate with Leonard DeClercq is correct, that the emissions are comparable to the city of Washington, D.C. It could be that their emissions are lower than that. It could be that they're higher than that. We need much more transparency to understand their total greenhouse gas emissions, because what we have is a very limited slice of data that they provided in, at two different points, one in 2016 and one more recently. And what we need is to really understand the parts of the picture that we don't yet know. For instance, the emissions from aircraft. You know, the aircraft, I hear them here while I'm here. They're flying all the time, not just over Oahu, but the ocean. And these are tremendously thirsty beasts. They consume and emit a lot.
And the data that you've been able to get from the military, the most recent, what does that date back to?
This is last week in response to a query that we made with Public Affairs. They sent us what they said was the request from the military for RIMPAC, the U.S. part. Remember, there's 28 other nations, right? But the U.S. part, Defense Logistics Agency, has provided them with tens of thousands of gallons of fuel. And that is different from the millions of gallons of fuel that were provided in 2016. So we want to understand why the discrepancy. Now, the public affairs people said that's not the total story. That's not all of it. But they gave us a number, and we've calculated the emissions from that. And it would be much smaller if this is so. But again, that's incomplete, and there are parts of the picture we don't know, especially from aircraft and allies getting here, flying from as far away as Italy and India, participating in exercises for days and then returning. So when you think about the known unknowns, we don't know the emissions of the 18 months of preparations, you know, where hundreds of people travel to California to plan the exercises. We don't know all of the emissions for the participating nations to get here and to return. We don't know all of the emissions from their operations while they're here. We just have small bits of information. And what we have tells us that the emissions from even the smaller, if it's so, request by RIMPAC for fuel from Defense Logistics Agency is larger than the emissions of entire countries for a year.
So you're trying to get some context, not just this small data point.
Right. So no one in the world has ever tried to estimate, at least in open sources, the effect of an operation like this, an exercise like this. And this is the largest naval exercise in the world that's held biannually, right? There are many exercises all the time. No one's ever tried to tell us what that impact is. And what we really need to understand is, what's the cost benefit here? Okay, because the emissions make us less secure. Climate change is certain. The wars that they're preparing us for are not certain. And we have room right now to diminish the impact of climate change if we reduce emissions for things that aren't needed or where there's room to reduce emissions. And that's why we're looking at this.
So we often hear national security, and that's what drives decisions by the military to do what they do. But you're saying there should be maybe some thought put into kind of the global security when it comes to climate.
Yes.
Based on what they do.
Right. And I think that it's clear that the military understands that emissions going up makes people less secure in a human security way, that the disasters, that the too much water or too little water, depending on where you are and when you are in these locations, the inability to prevent salination of groundwater as sea levels rise on island nations, that these make people less secure. They understand that, and they argue that the migration that is caused by climate change will make people less secure. Now, we can greet climate migrants warmly, or we can see them as a threat. And we don't have to see them as a threat. We can help people, and we can sort of diminish the need for people to move. And it has to be a holistic picture. I mean, the planet is in crisis, and it can get much worse. And putting things in perspective, these conflicts which might occur need to be put up against the change that is underway and that we need to diminish. And that's the kind of perspective I think that we need. The military understands a lot of this. They did the science in the 1950s and 1960s. They paid for it through the Office of Naval Research so that we could understand climate change. And they've understood it for decades. And they've recently begun to reduce their emissions substantially. But they are still the single largest energy user in the U.S. And these exercises are tremendously polluting in terms of greenhouse gases. So we need to put this all in a sort of bigger picture context and not let our fear of what might happen with China, which isn't necessarily going to happen, drive us to harm ourselves in another way.
You know, we always hear that it's keeping the peace, you know, versus open conflict, you know, where like we've got across the world in Ukraine and elsewhere. But yeah, that's the price that nobody's keeping tabs on, I guess, right?
Right. We have to have a long view.
Anything else or any final thoughts you want to leave listeners with?
Well, what's interesting is Congress has asked for more transparency from the Department of Defense on their emissions. And the DOD has been obliged to provide that. And President Biden actually ordered the military to have climate plans. They promised reductions. Now, the reductions that they promised are not ambitious. What we need to think about is raising the bar for both transparency and ambitious reductions. And that would entail rethinking U.S. foreign policy and our military commitments. For example, about a quarter to a third of emissions in any one year have been devoted to the Persian Gulf to protect access to oil that we shouldn't be burning. In fact, we're using much less imported oil in the United States and the world from that region. So therefore, we should dramatically reduce the size of the military. But many of those bases remain. There are tens of thousands of people stationed in just U.S. forces, not to mention other forces, in that region. And that can be reduced. So that's low-hanging fruit. Right? So, we can't burn that oil. We shouldn't burn that oil. And so we don't need it. We're not using it.
Pull back on our efforts to protect it.
And the same with Asia and the Pacific. The threat to Taiwan could be protected against, deterred in other ways than having an aircraft carrier nearby all the time with its flotilla of 10 ships and, you know, building up. Diplomacy is what we need. Peaceful solutions, peace, is less greenhouse gas intensive, but it can be provided through deterrence in a much different way, which would be less emitting.
Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate you carving out time for us to talk about
this. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We have been hearing from Anita Crawford, international relations professor at Oxford, and author of the book, The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, Charting the Rise and Fall of U.S. Military Emissions. We will have links on our website after the show. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we're trekking some rocky slopes in search of an insect that is a prime example of evolutionary adaptation in our islands. The flightless moth lives only in high mountain areas on one island. Its simple habitat consists of barren, rocky slopes where high winds and cold temperatures make flying difficult. Although its evolutionary ancestors could fly, this unusual insect has shortened wings that are useless for catching air currents. Instead, it gets around by hopping, much like a cricket, and is sometimes called a grasshopper moth. During the caterpillar stage, it spins webs in rock crevices, feeding on dead leaves blown into its webbing. Adults continue scavenging on leaf litter and feed on smaller insects as well. This insect is known by two names, but for today's backyard quiz, we want to know its name that refers to the mountain that is its exclusive habitat. Call 941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
The climate change lawsuit brought by Hawaii Youth against the Department of Transportation was recently settled earlier this month. So what does the outcome mean to youth in other places who have filed similar lawsuits? HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us with the answer. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so you talked to students from elsewhere across the continent.
Absolutely. So the Navahine versus the Department of Transportation case is one of over a dozen cases throughout the country that are led by young plaintiffs. And they're in total, among the cases that are represented by the law firm Our Children's Trust, about 150 young people who are involved in action against different state agencies or the federal government over their concerns about climate change. And I really wanted to hear what their reaction to the news was. We've been talking about the Navahine settlement a lot in terms of climate and legal precedent. But for the young people who had this shared experience of going into courtrooms and telling their stories in front of judges, in front of lawyers, in front of the case of Montana juries, what did it mean to have this settlement come through in Hawaii? And so the first plaintiff that I talked to was Sarah Hope Ballantyne, who is part of the Juliana versus the United States case. This case is out of Oregon, and it's against the federal government. It alleges that the federal government has violated the plaintiff's constitutional rights by continuing the promotion and export of fossil fuels. And Sarah Hope Ballantyne first signed on to the case when they were just 11, and now they're 19. So this case has really been going off on for half of Sahara's life. And so I asked them, you know, what was their reaction to this news about the Navajine settlement?
That was really, really exciting to hear. I'm sure the plaintiffs are overjoyed. It was awesome. It was really inspirational, I think, for me and a lot of the other plaintiffs, because in that case, we saw the government and, of course, the transportation services working with the youth, working with the plaintiffs to figure out how to, like, help each other. And in my case, there have been many opportunities for the federal government, for our president to come and work with us and figure it out together. And that hasn't happened. But the door is still open. And so I think it was a big inspiration and left me with a lot of hope about a similar thing hopefully happening to us in our lawsuit.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, there hasn't been any action on that particular lawsuit. And some of them have been dropped, right?
The Juliana case was actually dismissed by a panel of judges just a month before the settlement in Navajine came down, and that's brought that case essentially to a standstill. But the plaintiff that I talked to, Sahara, as well as representation for Our Children's Trust, said that they want to keep fighting, and the inspiration that they see in successes like Navajine really inspires them to keep going. Another success that has been had in kind of the spectrum of cases is in Held versus Montana. So that's a case out of Montana in which a group of young plaintiffs, again, the youngest of which was 2 when they signed on to be a part of this case, sued the government saying that Montana's issuing of contracts for fossil fuel projects violated their right to a clean and healthful environment. That language is protected under Hawaii's state constitution as well. So there's a little bit of shared DNA there. And that case was the first one of all of these cases to go to trial, and the plaintiffs actually won. The judge decided in their favor last August. But in Montana, that state, unlike what we've seen in Hawaii, representation for Montana is fighting this case tooth and nail. So they actually appealed to the state Supreme Court, and we're seeing opening arguments taking place this month in that case. So I talked to Claire Lassus. She's a 21-year-old plaintiff involved in Held versus Montana. And she found that just the camaraderie between people on both sides of the issue in Navajine and what the Navajine plaintiffs were able to achieve with their leadership to be really remarkable.
I'd want them to know that they are really, truly an inspiration to all of us, especially those of us that are still caught up in the middle of fighting our government for a cleaner and more sustainable future. And I hope that they know that they really are true leaders to the young people of this country and the world.
Yeah, I can see how they would be encouraged by this settlement, you know, and the added staff and just the acknowledgement that we have some responsibility to our youth.
Yeah, and the settlement has been celebrated by Governor Josh Green, by different representations or different members of the state transportation department, environmental activists, and the plaintiffs themselves who I talked to. But it's worth saying that Hawaii's council did originally try to have this case dismissed. And so even when you get a victory at the end of the day, it's still a lot to ask these young people to go through. You know, there's a lot of publicity involved in being in these cases. Many of them were deposed and had to appear in court. And so I spoke to one of the plaintiffs in the Navajine settlement, 17-year-old Messina from Kailua, about what all of that was like.
We knew we had a very strong case, and we knew that Hawaii was special in the way that we care for the land. And there is a little bit of that heart in our legal system here. And so I thought it would be a little bit easier, but I mean, looking at the precedent that we've had in our cases so far, they've had a lot of struggle just to be heard. So I was incredibly surprised and incredibly grateful that we were able to do it.
So do we know, were these young people able to connect with each other on Zoom just to give each other some, you know, feedback?
Yeah, so I was talking about it, and there is a little bit of mentorship between people who have gone through these cases. So Messina, for instance, says that she'll likely speak with plaintiffs involved in new cases that are starting now, about what the process is like. It's not quite what I envisioned, which was like one big group chat between all 150 of the plaintiffs. But the plaintiffs said that even if they don't know one another in person, Zahara, Claire, and Messina, they feel connected to the other plaintiffs because they have this kind of shared coming-of-age story. Many of them have grown up being involved in these cases, are now going to college, you know, are no longer youth in the traditional under 18 sense, are starting new chapters of their lives, and all know what it's like to be a part of this particular kind of legal moment where young people are activating around climate change.
You know, because some of these youth were so young when they, you know, put their name on this, I'm sure their parents were somehow involved, but you do kind of wonder if this will change their career path, you know, this activism.
Yeah, absolutely. So, for instance, Sahara is in college, as is Claire. They're both going to school on the continent, and they say it's really shaped their studies and career pursuits. Sahara wants to continue to work with the environment. Claire is really interested in working in public service. I talked to a handful of young people involved in cases, specifically the Navahina case, who were like really want to go into law, and working on these cases shaped their understanding of what that environment was like and what they specifically want to pursue in the legal field. But when I asked this question to Messina, she had a really interesting answer. So she's 17, and I broached her the question, you know, basically the classic question that old people like to ask young people, what do you want to do with your life? And she said she doesn't really think about a career related to climate later on. She wants that action to happen in her life now.
I believe if I have to go into climate science or climate law as an adult, we ran out of time. And of course, we're going to need incredible climate scientists and people for the future. But for me personally, I think that now is the time that we have to act. So it doesn't really make sense for me to look in the future and be like, oh, let me go into climate law and help climate change down the road, because we basically have 5 years to figure this out.
Yeah, they feel a sense of urgency.
Absolutely. And I mean, when you think of the youngest plaintiffs, like the plaintiff who is 2 years old in when the Held case was filed in 2020, they would now be, you know, six or seven. The world is going to look really different when they decide what they want to do as an adult. And so seeing kids say, now's the time for us to make these choices and stand up on these issues is quite powerful.
Yeah, very, very, very interesting. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking with HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. You can read more of her coverage of the Nabahini settlement on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hey there. It's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look into the world's biggest stories. Catch The Daily, Monday through Thursday at 1:30, here on HPR One.
On the next Fresh Air, John M. Chu, the director of Crazy Rich Asians and the film adaptation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical In the Heights. He has a forthcoming adaptation of the musical Wicked. He'll talk about making movies and being raised by immigrant parents who owned a Chinese restaurant in Silicon Valley. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
We now go to this week's Mono Minute. Thanks to Azino Kento, we've got the calls of an introduced desert game bird with a unique adaptation like no other. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the chestnut-bellied sand grouse.
Chestnut-bellied sand grouse are one of our many game birds that were introduced to Hawaii for hunting. Perhaps because they're native to the deserts of southern Sahara and India, they're able to do well and can only be found in the driest parts of Kohala on the Big Island. In addition to their chestnut-colored bellies, males and females are mostly mottled brown with a distinctive black necklace across their breast and a wingspan of about 2 feet. With their small heads and long pointed wings, they really stick out from any other game birds you might see in the area. Chestnut-bellied sand grouse eat mostly grass and weed seeds, and if you're lucky, you might see or even hear them overhead as they fly in small flocks between their foraging and roosting grounds. One really interesting characteristic of sand grouse is that the males have specially adapted feathers on their breast that allows them to soak up water like a sponge from far-off ponds and puddles and then carry it back to their thirsty nestlings. These little birds can then drink up to 4 teaspoons of water just by squeezing their dad's feathers with their bill. No other birds can do this, which is perhaps why chestnut-bellied sand grouse are so successful in the driest part of Hawaii. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Evergreen by Deborah. At evergreenbydeborah.com, learn more about porcelain tile by Royal Mosa, made using recycled water and hydroelectric power to create floor and wall tiles inspired by trends in design and architecture.
Now it's time to release the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about a unique insect found in our islands. Habitat loss has confined these bugs to elevations above 9,500 feet. Its evolutionary ancestors were able to fly, but environmental conditions such as high winds and low temperatures probably contributed to its descendants evolving to only having partial wings. Instead of flight, these critters travel by hopping from place to place like a grasshopper, lending to one of its common names, the grasshopper moth. Fun fact, it can leap 10 times its body length. At the caterpillar stage, the grub weaves a web that it uses to trap and feed on the dead leaves that blow by. This moth has adapted and managed to survive extreme temperature changes on a Maui peak that averages from 50 to 65 degrees Fahrenheit during the day and often drop well below freezing at night. It's a place where the air is thin and solar radiation is intense, but it is home for the Haleakala flightless moth, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz. And congrats to our winner, Abalon from Waikoloa Village. You got it right. Have an idea for a quiz you'd like to share? Write to Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii's primary election is about 2 weeks away, so what can we expect as we prepare to vote? Well, HPR reporter Ashley Mizzou is here to talk about a new movement among local candidates. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so about 48 political candidates have signed on to the Our Hawaii Pledge. It's a commitment to turn down campaign donations over $100 from sources like corporate lobbyists, developers, hotels, military contractors. And it's really part of a movement from Our Hawaii, which is a political progressive action group that wants to take big money interests out of Hawaii politics.
Though different candidates may get elected to office every election cycle, a lot of them still are a part of the same status quo. We have a system that allows for the influence of money in politics, and legislators who are not wanting to change that system because many of the ones that are in office currently got there through that system and are from it and benefit from it.
And that's Evan Weber, one of the founders of Our Hawaii. And, you know, it's kind of following all of these different types of scandals from, you know, former lawmakers Kalani English and Ty Cullen, who were sentenced for taking political bribes, or businessman Milton Choi, who was also convicted of bribing lawmakers and Maui officials. And so for Our Hawaii, it's kind of a push to push candidates to accept donations at a more grassroots level, not, you know, taking these big donations from big corporations or these special interest groups.
So what does this mean for those who can donate to these candidates and who cannot?
Yeah, so if you sign on to the Our Hawaii pledge, that rules out donations from, you know, a range of groups, including, you know, some of the biggest donators in the state, I would say, people, these PACs that donate thousands and thousands of dollars to campaigns. For example, the Hawaii Realtors Political Action Committee has donated over $71,000 to candidates this year. And if you've signed on to this Our Hawaii pledge, you wouldn't be able to accept any of that money. Also out of bounds would be Alexander and Baldwin, which along with its executives have given over $18,000 this year. And even like construction companies like Non Inc., whose employees have donated more than $20,000. So it's these big hitters in Hawaii that, you know, just pour money into politics here. And some of, if you sign on to this pledge, you would not be able to accept those funds.
Right, it's pay to play.
Right. And so political analyst Colin Moore says candidates who sign on to the pledge probably aren't going to lose much, though. And it's likely going to, in fact, bolster their campaign.
The signing this pledge can be a valuable way for these candidates to signal that they share the values of Our Hawaii. I don't think that the candidates who've signed are the sort of candidates who would be accepting those donations anyway. And so I think for them, this is, for many of the signers, this is an obvious thing to do.
Yeah, so I imagine that it's a lot of the newer, the newbies, right?
And definitely more, some of the more progressive candidates or more progressive incumbents that we see. There are some conservative Republicans who have signed on to this, as well as I think some of the other parties. I think they have at least one person from the Green Party. So it's kind of a range of people who have signed on to this pledge. But when, you know, Colin Moore says that it would be an obvious choice if you're one of these types of candidates, it was the case for Representative Natalia Hussey Burdick. You know, she's facing a tight race against Mike Lee, who she beat in 2022 by only about 240 votes. But, you know, she explained that the issue is, you know, more subtle than just doing blatant political favors for donors. It's those interactions in the gray area.
It's mostly just after years and years and years of accepting those donations, and those donations really being the bulk of what keeps you in office, it gains those lobbyists the access that our normal community members don't have. They are able to get late night meetings sometimes. They're able to get secret behind closed door meetings where nobody knows what they said.
Right. And, you know, someone else, Representative Amy Peruso, who has also signed on to the pledge, kind of echoed this. She's really talked about how campaign contributions are a reflection of candidates' values. So, for example, she has accepted donations from labor unions like the Hawaii Government's Employee Association.
They have to have their members' best interests in mind. For me, it's really about, like, whose interests do you serve? And I want to serve the interests not of the wealthy, elite, privileged, but of working class people, our public workers. They're radically underpaid. And most of them are doing, like public workers in particular, are doing the work of three people because we're starving those public agencies.
And, you know, unions are also big donors in these elections. You know, HGA this year has donated $4,500. The Painters Union has donated over $6,000. And the Hawaii Teachers Association has donated over $4,000. And so, you know, you might be giving up these big corporations, but you're also still able to accept, you know, funds from various others. And then also one thing that Evan Weber said when I was talking to him, he says it can be used during your campaign to get more grassroots efforts, to get more individual donors to say, you know, your $10, $15, $20 donation matters more to me because I'm not accepting these thousands of dollars from these corporations. And so it can be kind of a marketing tactic too.
Yeah, and when you've got the HGA, and that's the largest public sector union, you know, so they represent so many people across the political spectrum in that regard. But yeah, so you know, we're hearing a lot about, you know, small donations, right? Even with Kamala Harris saying the money that she raised in the 24 hours, a lot of it came from, you know, smaller donors versus bigger donors.
Right. And, you know, Our Hawaii is also a piece of this puzzle because they also raise funds to donate to candidates and provide resources for campaigns like volunteers and stuff. And, you know, in the 2022 election, Our Hawaii endorsed several candidates who signed on the pledge, and they intend to endorse more this election season. Weber said that Our Hawaii's 2023 and 2024 revenue has been about 75% grassroots donations. However, I do need to note that the organization kind of found itself in some hot water last year following some media reports about its fundraising from Maui Recovery that could have been used not only for just disaster relief efforts, but also to fund political campaigns. But Weber ultimately hopes that, you know, like one day Our Hawaii would not have to donate to candidates at all because elections would be publicly funded.
Working towards here is getting governing majorities that can actually enact structural reform to do things like campaign finance reform and public financing of elections. But in the meantime, we are trying race by race, candidate by candidate, to put better people in office that will make those things possible for the people of Hawaii.
Yeah, and I know there's been lots of concern about, overhauling the campaign election laws just to close some of these loopholes.
Right. And I think, you know, these types of bills do go through the legislature, and like the public financing of elections, that was a bill this past session that didn't quite make it through past the finish line. And so the idea for this organization is, I think, to elect lawmakers that would be more interested in passing that type of campaign reform so that they can reform the system from the inside. So the more people that sign onto this pledge and the more people who kind of follow that, the more that they can get elected, the closer they would get to their goal of, you know, publicly funded elections. And I wanted to also note that, you know, ballots have, as you said, come out already. If you are signed up to be a mail-in voter, you've already received your ballot.
Yes, I did. I got mine in the
mail.
Yeah,
me too. And I think that the Office of Elections kind of do a little bit of a rebrand on Election Day, and that's it's a deadline. The August 10th is a deadline to turn in your ballot. So you can turn it in starting from now all the way until August 10th. So I think they're trying to do a push to get people to turn their ballots in early if they can.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Ashley Mizuo about the Our Hawaii pledge that some local candidates for office have signed in an effort to take big money interests out of Hawaii politics. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, the educational nonprofit In Peace celebrates its 30th anniversary. We talked to one of the founders about the impact that the organization has made in our community. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our shows archived online on our website, or you can find it as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.